In a world where uncertainty reigns supreme, where shadows of chaos dance at every turn, one truth emerges unyielding. Preparation is not a luxury, but a lifeline. Behold the Wellness Company, a beacon of readiness amidst the tempestuous seas of fate. Envision a sanctuary of tranquility, where the tumult of unforeseen medical crises finds no purchase. The Wellness Company's Medical Emergency Kit stands as a bastion of assurance, a fortress of resilience against the unseen foes of health. Within its sacred confines lie the tools of salvation. Ivermectin, to ward off the insidious whispers of disease. Emergency antibiotics, to quell the raging storms of infection. Antivirals, to vanquish the relentless tides of contagion, and more. The Wellness Company Medical Emergency Kit is not merely a collection of supplies, it is the embodiment of preparedness itself. Crafted by the hands of esteemed healers led by luminaries such as Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. James Thorpe, Dr. Harvey Risch, and Dr. Drew Pinsky, this kit stands as the pinnacle of safety, the zenith of prevention. These truth-seeking doctors have forged a testament to vigilance, a testament to the unwavering pursuit of well-being. Embrace the certainty that comes from being armed against adversity. Embrace the Wellness Company, for in its embrace lies the promise of resilience, the promise of a brighter tomorrow amidst the chaos of today. Don't wait for the next crisis to strike. Visit twc.health/strangeplanet and use promo code STRANGEPLANET for an exclusive 10% discount. Prepare today and rest easy tomorrow.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Richard Serrett's Strange Planet. Following the truth wherever it leads. Exposing evil and corruption and the secret machinations of powerful elites. Revealing the high strangeness beneath the surface of our supposed reality. Coming to you from the Great White North and his studio beneath the stairs. Here's Richard.
And welcome once again to Strange Planet. On this episode, we're going to delve into magic and the origin of art, science, and culture. Let me just crib here briefly from the back cover of a brand new book by Carl Abramson. Since the dawn of time, magic is the node around which all human activities and culture revolve. As magic entered the development of science, art, philosophy, religion, myth, and psychology, it still retained its essence. That we have a dynamic connection with all other forms of life. And as I mentioned, the author, Carl Abramson, is with us. He writes fiction, material about the arts and entertainment, esoteric history, occulture, as well as artists' portraits for the international market. He lectures on all of the aforementioned subjects of art schools, universities, events, symposia, and conferences, and also works with filmmaking in publishing, photography, and music. Previously, he authored Occulture, Residences, and Anton LaVey and the Church of Satan. Carl, welcome to Strange Planet. How are you?
Thank you very much. It's great to be here, and I'm doing great. Thank you.
I want to dial back to your previous book just for a moment, if I could. Occulture. What do you mean? What is occulture?
Well, it's in part, you could say it's a punny joining of two words, the occult and culture. And they go really well together. And that's, you know, technically. But also as a phenomenon, it's something that is very, very interesting. It's become sort of my obsession in a way. This merger signifies when something has moved from being occult, meaning hidden, meaning ostracized, meaning rejected, meaning perhaps staying outside, staying hidden because of self-preservation. But anyway, this movement into perhaps not the mainstream, but also the mainstream, but mainly into culture, our general culture. And this could be for many reasons. For instance, it could be because of survival of an idea. You know, if something is contained in an environment that's traditionally obfuscating, you know, for protection or self-preservation or outer pressure, there's a chance that those ideas become inert. You know, if there's like no new blood, no development, no working with the idea, just something that you contain in a container because it's supposed to be a secret, you know. For things to be alive, they need to move, they need to flow. And so when an idea moves, it could, for instance, move into a higher sphere of general acceptance. There are many examples of this, of course. It could be, it doesn't necessarily have to do with hocus pocus, you know, something magical per se, moving into becoming, you know, a Harry Potter kind of presence in our culture. It could also do with something scientific, something that's been regarded as, you know, not worth the while or rejected, but that someone, a scientist, decides to take a look at again after maybe 100 years, 200 years, and they say, wow, this is not so bad after all. Let's get rid of the dust of this particular idea and see if we can apply or implement it in our present time. You know, that's also what I call an acculturation, when something moves from the occult into the mainstream. So it's a word that signifies, I will say, mainly stuff that comes from the hocus pocus history that we have. It could be religious stuff, it could be spiritual stuff, it could be pre-scientific things that are now growing with more people aware that it's growing out in the open, you know, not necessarily underneath the surface in the soil, but up in the garden, you know, powered by sunlight and for general consumption in a way.
Right. So, for example, astrology. I mean, we can read the astrology in the weekend newspaper, and mind you, very superficial, but most people are aware of, they could tell you what their sign is. You know, that was the big thing in the 70s, right? What's your sign? Things like, I have friends when we worked together and we were on the road in a hotel at night, one of them would pull out the tarot deck, and we were all fascinated. We didn't know much about it, but it was a curiosity. Ouija boards, right? Mm-hmm. You can still, Parker Brothers, I think, still produces Ouija boards. So these, I don't know, these are like vestiges from the past that we haven't let go of, but why do they stick with us? Why are they still here?
Okay, that's a very good question. Now you're getting me started. I believe that this general process of acculturation that's going on. Let's also mention one more example that I think people are, they realize how this works, you know. Even in the 70s and the 60s and further back, yoga was something that looked something weird, something fringe, something occult, you know. So you go to some ashram in India and stay with a guru, you know, like the Beatles, whatever. But today it's like the most commonplace thing, where every housewife and her friend, you know, goes to yoga in these sort of yoga clothes with yoga mats. It's a lifestyle thing. That's a prime example of acculturation. The reason why these things have remained so vital is that they speak to deeper layers of ourselves. I wouldn't go so far as to call it like deeper layers of our soul, but just to our being, to our existence. Perhaps, for instance, we have an inherent need of using a tool, something visual, to mirror back to us with a symbol to mirror back. We can project on that and get something back. We could also call that a very intuitive process. It's not necessarily something, you know, occult in the sense that there are other outer forces telling us secrets. It could just be simply like Carl Jung said, you know, there are deeper layers of our soul and we need to communicate with those in order to find more meaning in life and also more information about ourselves. So things that have never gone away. You mentioned astrology. That's a prime mirror in a way, because of course we are all vain. We are all curious about ourselves and how other people look upon us. So we want to know what's going on in these sort of non-rational or irrational layers or aspects of our life. And of course, what a great mirror to have, you know, space with the planets and these incredibly powerful forces that they are, even in a scientific way of looking at things. They are really powerful forces. So of course they will affect us. So you mentioned brief superficial astrological analyses that might not really be correct, like in general media. But then of course, we have these astrologers who devote their lives to interpret this tradition. I'm sure there are many, you know, con people who are not serious, who just want to make a quick buck, etc., by reading people, like a cold reading of people, and then projecting back what they think they want to hear, you know. But I believe that all of these things, let's call them mirrors or oracular tools, they are attractive simply because we are interested in ourselves. And if psychology in general, or our gossiping or self-help books, if that they can't fill the deeper needs that we have, then we need to go something else, for instance, into religion, for instance, into other kinds of spirituality. There's an inherent need there. And I think today specifically, there's a bit of a warning sign because we are flooded with news and information about how dire straits, you know, we're actually in with the planet, the climate, all kinds of things. And there are wars. We are in dire straits. So how does the individual human cope with all of this angst that evokes, you know? And I would say one of the ways is to instinctively look for new avenues, new ways of thinking, new ways of acting. And we can rationally say that, yeah, this is not so good. But then again, it usually stops on that level because we are creatures of comfort. We are in the comfort zone. We are usually very rigid, not willing to, you know, budge until there's a real catastrophe looming. But that's the problem. There is a catastrophe looming. So I think it's part of the survival instinct that we are now a little bit more open-minded and we look at these traditional things that we've had in our culture and assessing them and seeing maybe there's something here that we should take a look at. And that one of those things could be, for instance, shamanic cultures and sort of indigenous cultures, where traditionally those cultures are living closer to the earth, both literally and metaphorically.
I do want to come back to nature and magic. Mm-hmm. But so much of our culture here in the West is, for better or worse, it's pop culture. And it's driven by social media and it's driven by memes and awards shows where you have the latest it person who's popular with a song, and sometimes we see them up there and they're flashing interesting occult symbols and signs. And what is that all about? I mean, is that a marketing ploy, or are they not maybe fully conscious of, you know, where that's coming from?
I would say that it's hard to generalize like 100% about that. Of course, there are exceptions. There might be some people who are, you know, devoted or seriously interested in a philosophy and then flaunt a symbol or whatever. However, I do think in these contexts that you're talking about, meaning public life, pop culture, shows, social media, etc., it's such a, what's the name of that Tom Wolfe book? it's such a bonfire of the vanities in a way. You know, it's here today, gone tomorrow. It's evanescent. It's just like little flares, not even fireworks. The reason why that is, it's been like that for 100 years or more. It's just to, I don't know, provide the anxious with some form of light entertainment to take their minds off of their lives with which they are not happy. Because if you were happy and content and had meaning in your life, you probably wouldn't spend so much time on social media. You would be actually doing things and interacting with real human beings and not be so vain, because that's essentially what it's about. You know, it's like weak people become the bullies. People starved for attention will become, you know, very exhibitionistic. There are all these compensations going on. And that's true for that social media culture also. Even technology is adapting to our vanities with, for instance, these little nice filters that make your skin smooth and you can have little funny things attached to your face. And people go, wow, that's so cool. How do they do that? But in actual fact, it's kind of simple. But the question is rather, why do they do that? And, you know, why are you looking at it? Because it tends to dumb people down. They just want something new after this app or that app. And now with AI and different kinds of AI implementations of, well, basically creating human expression in a kind of a flawless way. I think it's a bit terrifying, but I think that the reason why that is happening is simply to keep people on the edge and focused on the screen and focused on things that are not conducive to finding real meaning on their own individual level.
There are directors who, though, delight in sort of encoding films. I call them little Easter eggs with occultic symbols and or occult themes. Why do they do that, do you suppose, above and beyond just maybe for kicks? And, you know, it's like, wow, did you see that? What he did there, that was interesting, in terms of film. Or do these these hidden occultic symbols, do they have power or meaning above and beyond the artistic?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question also, because usually when you talk about really old philosophies that you could put under the umbrella of the occult or spiritual, or whatever you want to call it, they're usually called perennial philosophy, just like perennial flowers that just keep growing year after year after year. And when something is perennial and thereby integrated in our culture, it may not be visible. It may be relegated to some dusty corners of a university or a library, but still it's there, you know, we can relate to it. And the things you mentioned before with the tarot and astrology are good examples of that. So I think that when a director chooses to integrate these things, probably it's because to titillate or create some kind of something that is cool. It's also quite common. I've seen that every 10 years or so, there's a cycle when suddenly fashion for young people start using a lot of symbols, but they have no real meaning because they're just casual t-shirts for kids even. However, of course, there are exceptions. There could be directors, if we're talking about film, who want to convey a message in which this symbol has a function. It carries signal in a way. So I think it depends on what we're looking at, how superficial the film is or how substantial it is. If it's generally a substantial film, when you know that there's a kind of an artistic director who has say-so, or an artistic screenwriter who has say-so, and you find that there's enough intelligence there that nothing's superfluous, then you could say that if there's an occult symbol or several in the film, that probably has a meaning. They want to impose that meaning into their work. Whereas in fact, if it's just what you call it, the sort of in the line of Raiders of the Lost Ark or The Mummy or things like that, then it's just for kicks. They just cull something from the little pool of coolness, cool symbols.
Right. Let's go back to the brand new one, Source Magic. Let's get a definition. What is source magic?
Over this past decade, I have been thinking specifically about these things. And as you mentioned, I've written another book called Occulture. And this is a kind of a follow-up to Occulture in the sense that I tend to look at things going on right now and try to figure out why they are going on and what exactly is it about. So source magic is kind of the primeval magic that comes from us being associated with a source. And I've gone so far in this book that I call the source actually that magic is the source and the source is magic. And why is this relevant? Well, if you look at human culture, you tend to, if you look way, way, way back into what we call prehistoric times, we still know enough based on evidence that's been left, you know, the cave wall paintings and other items that we can follow from a long time ago. And we can see that remaining in a few archaic cultures that haven't really changed that much. And there, that's usually what's called a shamanic culture. There is someone in the tribe that goes on transcendental journeys or inner journeys, you can call it what you want, but they leave the rational mind frame and they go into a place inside themselves where they have visions and they interpret these visions kind of a irrational way of acquiring information. And this information traditionally has been used not only for like selfish reasons for the person, but for the tribe or the little group or the family. So you have this thing where you use an irrational mind frame to get information that's conducive to the well-being of a slightly smaller group or a slightly bigger group also for that matter. So those are our origins of knowledge. Knowledge that is acquired and shared. And then if you look at human beings, human cultures spreading, we don't have to look at the entire globe, but just focus on one little tribe, for instance. As that grows and it becomes agrarian, meaning non-nomadic, it starts farming, there's still this inherent need because we didn't know at the time what the hell was going on. You know, why is there thunder? Why is there, you know, snow coming? It must be, you know, the gods up there affecting us adversely or in a good way. So we have to appease them in a way or make them happy, dealing with outer forces. But at the same time, the information about how you do that comes from the inside. So as things grow, this becomes a process of what I call, you know, proxy shamanic. That means that there are priests, for instance, or magicians, sorcerers that you don't know personally, but that still has that function for the larger group, a group in which you may not know all the people. And then further on down the line, you have towns and cities and even countries and the parts of the world with so many people, yet the knowledge is preserved, and the way you get knowledge is preserved in this inner journeying, the shamanic. And that's what I call the source. The source is the inner source where knowledge and wisdom actually comes from, and it can then be processed for the benefit of the tribe. And in extension, we have religion. In extension, we also have science. In extension, we have basically anything in human culture comes from this original source. Today, empiricists, you know, scientists will say that that's just a lot of hokum, that's bullshit and airy fairy hocus pocus. But in actual fact, when you get to that level of dialogue, there is one fundament of empiricism. And what is that? It's not the method itself of checking and rechecking and checking. It is speculation. You know, everything comes from a speculative idea that is then tossed into the cauldron or on the slab to be dissected and looked at, you know, and every empiricist knows that. Everything begins in an irrational sphere that is then gradually rationalized in a way. And it's the same process. And where does information come from? Where does knowledge come from? It comes from inside, from originally one person designated to be the interpreter of the outside world through journeying inwards.
It seems in our culture that we still sort of allow for that source magic, or we accept that source magic influences the artist. Mm-hmm. You know, where does that song come from? You know, Paul McCartney, for example, is always talking about he's the antenna. He doesn't write the music. It comes from somewhere else and so forth. But we don't, as you say, because of the, you know, materialism, I guess, after the, you know, the Enlightenment and the Industrial Revolution, we don't allow for science and source magic to sort of be mentioned in the same sentence. However, it does seem like if you look at what's happening in certain fields, like physics or quantum physics, it seems like they are starting to realign. Talk to me a bit about that.
Yeah. Absolutely. They surely have. And I mean, it's not a recent thing either. I think the 20th century was such a groundbreaking and revolutionary century in many ways. If you are creatively inclined, for instance, say you're interested in art or culture, then you tend to stick with that. That's your field. And then you tend to look at everything else in human culture as, you know, they don't understand, or they're simple, or they're too left brain, etc. And of course, that goes for if you're interested in science, then you might not be so interested in experimental art, for instance. But something that the 20th century showed us very well was that there was a general like upheaval, a new way of looking at things. And I mean, it's apparent in art, absolutely, because suddenly you had this really explosive experimental art in Dada and Surrealism, and later on postmodern experimentalism, and, you know, something completely unseen before. The 19th century was the height of sort of what you call bourgeois art, with painting, decorative, figurative, that gradually sort of exploded into impressionism and more abstractions in a way. And in psychology, we could see that too. Psychology went from being something distinctly clinical and pathologizing into going into more psychoanalytic fields, you know, going deeper and deeper into what are the drives, what drives people, and how do they relate to their own drives.
Archetypes.
And also going inside to find those answers, not necessarily some experts standing on the outside defining what it is. And in physics, then, of course, the most famous one is Einstein and, you know, the theory of relativity that most of us still cannot understand what it's about. But it was a big thing that was eventually accepted by the environment or of physics. But that was not the case in the beginning. Then it was just like hocus pocus, actually. And later on, I think today, perhaps the Einsteinian paradigms are perhaps looked upon as conservative today. I don't know. But for sure, as you mentioned, you know, quantum physics in general, this thing where there are parallel timelines, alternate universes, etc., etc., that sounds still like science fiction, but it's something that physicists work with on a day-to-day basis. And it's all about, it's the same thing. It's changing paradigms in order to find new things that can connect dots that are as yet mysterious. It's basically taking up the stones under which you haven't looked yet and see what crawls underneath, in a way. So you could say that it's... acculturation in general requires a new way of looking at things in order to find out deeper lying truths, hidden strata that contain new information to look at perhaps the same thing, but in a new way.
Carl will take a quick time out, come back, and continue to discuss Source Magic, the origin of art, science, and culture.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
This is Amy Poehler. My new movie, Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, is coming to theaters June 14th, and it's making me feel joy and sadness and anger, definitely some disgust, and I think a little fear. Really? But I'm also feeling these new emotions like anxiety, embarrassment, envy, and ennui.
It's what you call the boredom.
Okay, that one was weird. It's going to be the feel-everything movie of the summer. Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, only in theaters June 14th. Get tickets now.
This episode is brought to you by Snapple. Welcome to the Snapple Market Auditory Experience. Close your eyes. Imagine you're walking into your neighborhood store. You make your way to the back and reach for your favorite Snapple flavor. You can't wait. You take a sip. Whoa, that's a lot of flavor. What flavor are you holding? Now open your eyes and check out Snapple.com to find ridiculously flavorful Snapple near you.
As you're staring up at the night sky, ever wonder who's staring back? You're listening to Richard Serrett's Strange Planet.
Carl Abramson, Source Magic, the origin of art, science, and culture. What do you mean by magical realism?
That is a term that... I perhaps appropriated or used it. It usually comes from literature, from the history of literature and from the study of literature, and I think it's become too generic in a way. It usually relates to South American authors that sprinkle their stories with a bit of irrational stardust in a way, fairly straightforward stories that somehow, formally, the way they're written, or in terms of contents, are fantastic. And I mean literally fantastic, not as a value judgment. It could be some weirdness going on that doesn't belong in that kind of context. That's I wouldn't say a tradition, but it's a literary scene. It's been around for a while. And I like it very much because there are... there's wisdom in there in the actual technique. And I'm so interested in magic in general. And it's interesting because fiction is magic. It's the creation of a magical universe that you can share with another reader. So what happens as these magical realists do? What happens if you integrate in fiction, a fictional narrative, something that is off key, something that is slightly askew, something that is not the way it's supposed to be? Well, it becomes interesting, creatively interesting, because that's exactly what people will go for and say, well, what's this? It's like if you have a little area on your hand that itches, then you will scratch it. It's something that is not supposed to be there, but that of course becomes the most interesting thing there is, because it goes against the grain. It's not supposed to be there in a way. And in the book, I write about these things concerning, for instance, media narratives. I have magical realism on one hand and what I call realistic magic on the other hand, that being this thing where the technology and the aesthetics of reporting, for instance, when you see something that is shaky, obviously filmed on a smartphone, then immediately our association is that it's news and it's true. You know, the way it looks makes us interpret a little clip, although it could be completely fabricated. And if we have something that is super lavish with scenography, set design, wardrobe, makeup, lighting, then we interpret that as fiction because that's the way we've been programmed to interpret sort of these two examples of moving images. And I'm not really trying to argue anything in this sense of magical realism, but I do believe that we are very susceptible to influence by producers using these two extremes, carrying supposed truth, carrying supposed fantasy. And I'm interested in, what happens if they merge in a way. And I can see that there will be much more experiments in the future. I mean, for instance, technologically, there are already movies being made on cell phones, and they're not really trying to emulate that sort of news running down the street with a shaky camera thing, because cameras on cell phones are so good nowadays that you can actually shoot movies with them and they look good. But what I'm talking about is, I guess just a desire that people are discerning and that they think critically when they watch media, because in this day and age, media is no longer the sole, what do you call it? Anyone can produce good-looking stuff. That's what I'm trying to, because technology is really good and it's fairly inexpensive.
It's
So
become
you know someone.
democratized. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good term. Exactly. And that means potentially great radical changes both for fiction and also for news reporting. And when we're on the subject of film cameras in cell phones, I remember very well when there was no such thing because they simply didn't exist. And then they came and there was democratization and were also used in media, from, oh, there's an uproar here, there's an uprising, there's a war zone, and you have these shaky images. And it has turned out great, truly, in a democratizing way, is that, for instance, oppression has been able to, you've been able to clamp down on oppression because there's literary evidence in people's cell phone footage to show, for instance, that guy didn't have an accident, that guy was murdered, things like that. So, but of course, that teaches us that anything we see that has that look carries inherent truth. But that, of course, is not the case. And the media producers and producers of fiction, they know that. So it can become a dangerous thing when we become too accustomed to one particular kind of aesthetics, because that aesthetic can then be you can insert messages in there that are not supposed to be in there, so to speak.
Talk to me about the relationship between magic and nature.
In the book, in one of the pieces, I write that magic is. And that's from my point of view. I call myself a magical anthropologist, someone who studies humans' relation to magic historically and culturally. And when I write that magic is, what I mean by that is that it's so imbued in everything in human culture, not only historically, traditionally, when we were primitive societies and we had this sort of shamanic approach, but it still is. We are still the same cave beings, actually, with some pretty civilized surface crust added. One other thing that is and simply is and is also all permeating is, of course, nature. Nature is. And so thereby you have a relation there that we, whatever we do, has to do with our relationship to nature. And it may sound strange when, for instance, you might be sitting in a large city with, millions of people. The only trees you see is like a little park structure. But apart from that, it's just concrete and tall buildings and glass and metal. And you walk on concrete, so you're not even walking on soil. However, as individuals of so-called civilization, we don't have to go that deep within ourselves to realize that we are natural beings. We belong in nature. And this weird thing is just nature that we have created for ourselves for reasons of efficiency, for reasons of commerce, for reasons of many things. We can never divest ourselves of our connection to nature. And when we really do that, for instance, when we build and construct things that are detrimental to our own survival, then we have actively left nature, meaning, for instance, building buildings with materials that may be cheap, but that may be dangerous to us to live in, you know. And then it becomes something very poignant and visceral, you know. The lack of connectivity, connection to nature becomes threatening to our well-being. And of course, there are so many examples of how benevolent it is to simply be in nature. It could be taking a walk in the forest or go hiking or immersing yourself in water, the ocean or a river. And these things are not necessarily easy to explain rationally why. I'm sure some scientists can. Psychologists and biologists can say that, oh, when you're immersed in the cold water, there are endorphins that make you feel happy and satiated and just, you know, content. And that's fair and fine. But I think that it goes deeper than that. I think it goes down to the levels where you feel connectivity, where you feel a connection with everything that's alive. And that's one of the shamanic cornerstones in what I call the source, or also source magic, in the sense that holistic approach means that we are all, everyone, everything, our dogs, our pets, our bugs, we're all part of the same biosphere. So again, it's not just hocus pocus talking. It's a real scientific fact that we are all part of a biosphere. And then if you look at things like sentience, you know, I am me, I am aware that I am me, I can reflect many layers upon my identity, my existence, and I can see a kinship with you. I can see a kinship with basically all human beings because we have, you know, similar features, and we can speak. English is not my first language, but we can still communicate because we've taught ourselves to be communicative, communicating individuals. And I think that one key feature in the process of becoming more aware, becoming more sentient in a way, is proximity to nature. You have to expose yourself to the outer nature. And that's a real problem because there's an increasing movement, development on this planet towards urbanization. And that means literally moving away from nature into the urban human constructed things. And that, I think, will be extremely detrimental to humanity. It already is, because it also changes short term the mind frame of the people living there into accepting newly created things that are detrimental as being benevolent. Whereas, in fact, I'm not, you know, proselytizing that everybody should go back to nature and become hippies. But I do believe that it's conducive to health, balance, clear-mindedness, to be regularly exposed to nature as such, not to go into a zoo, not to watch it on National Geographic Channel, but to actually go into a park, go into a forest, go on a trip to somewhere wild, mountains, rivers, all these things, because to me and to many, many others, it's something that fills you, revitalizes you. And again, I could see that scientifically it could be proven, you know, maybe it's like an infusion of more oxygen, an infusion of magnetic energies from the uncorrupted soil in a way. I'm sure there are many technical explanations why it's good, but on the whole, I believe it's great to just like be with animals, be with other people. I'm not saying you have to hug a tree, but to just be in the vicinity of a forest or inside a forest, it's great. And everybody knows it. Kids know it. Kids love it. Indigenous culture revere it. That's their religion. And it's something that I feel we have to stress. That's a strange word to say, but we have to stress the value of going into nature.
We'll take another time out and come back. A few minutes remain with Carl Abramson, the author of Source Magic. Stay with us.
Listen up, true crime fans.
There's a big murder trial underway.
Dateline is launching a new podcast with Andrea Canning.
Welcome to Dateline True Crime Weekly.
We'll cover breaking crime news around the country with the best reporters on the case, NBC News analysts, and Dateline producers on the ground.
Over. Break it down for us.
You'll get behind-the-scenes scoops from crime scenes to courtrooms.
So tell us what he said.
Listen to Dateline True Crime Weekly now and catch new episodes every Thursday.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Andrew Gold, a fallen BBC journalist interviewing the heretics and rebels brave enough to speak out against mainstream narratives. Here's Coleman Hughes, John Ronson, and the Trigonometry podcast guys bringing controversy to the fore.
How'd you feel if a person of a different race moved in next door?
I spent a while with a politically correct faction of the Ku Klux Klan.
The system punishes people for wrongthink. It's heartbreaking.
Here's My Unorthodox Life Netflix star Julia Hart on getting out of a Hasidic Jewish cult.
Why can't I be okay with being silent and subservient? Everyone else is.
And biologist Richard Dawkins on trans activism.
It's perfectly legitimate to say, I'm a man, but I feel feminine. But to then say, therefore I am a woman, is just a betrayal of language.
Now it's your turn. Rebel against the mainstream and find a home in this sensible alternative space by subscribing to Heretics Podcast.
This is Richard Serrett's Strange Planet. Follow Richard on Twitter at Richard Serrett. For show information, visit the website strangeplanet.ca.
Carl, I want to dial back again to another book, but before that, just a reminder, this is the new one, Source Magic, The Origin of Art, Science, and Culture. And that is your book on Anton LaVey and the Church of Satan. And admittedly, you know, it's always kind of a tricky conversation for me. I'm an Orthodox Christian, and when we think of Anton LaVey and the Church of Satan, that's kind of that's a no-go zone. What is it important for people to understand? What am I missing about Anton LaVey and the Church of Satan? Was he a showman? Was there a deeper meaning there? Was it about shock value? Who was this guy?
I think he was a bit of everything, and I think he would agree to that description, because he was obviously aware of the controversial aspects of the symbol. It wasn't a real thing. He didn't believe in any, like, you know, anthropomorphic devil or anything like that. It was a symbol for him, and he knew it was controversial, and yet it was something that he felt an affinity with, like a resonance with culturally. And I think that he was interested in topics like psychology, like magic and occultism, and experimented and, you know, tried to find his way. And he realized that this has power, because it has the power to attract a few, but mainly repel more people. And if you have a strong symbol, of course, you will get a lot of attention, most of it being negative attention. So he wanted to make his concoction, call it the Church of Satan, of course, very controversial and provocative. Yet within that little group that attracted, again, a few people, whereas most were sort of confounded or negative. But he did get a lot of media attention. So he had a great chance to talk about what he really believed in. And I've called it pop Nietzsche. You know, for an American market, he sort of distilled Nietzsche and similar philosophers of will, Schopenhauer, you know, people talking about will and how important will is for a human being to be find meaning, you know, and not be just like a little flower in the wind that goes this way and that way, just to have a focus and find meaning in your life. So in that sense, he was consciously aware media person, and he was good at it. And what he was selling, in the sense that, you know, he wrote some books, the Satanic Bible, Satanic Rituals, so he was selling books. But at the same time, because I got to know him eventually towards the end of his life, I could see that there was more than mere showmanship. There was more than just, you know, hawking books in a way, or trying to make a fortune out of fooling susceptible people. The general assumption, which was also mine, is that it was a valid organization dealing with serious topics. Yes, anti-Christian. But at that time, meaning mid-60s, when the Church of Satan appeared, they were kind of an interesting group, because they were right in between the very conservative, rigid America that was invested in the Vietnam War, and, you know, and then you had the weird hippies and the flower children and the psychedelic revolution going on the other hand, that were just like, you know, let it hang loose and free love. And in between these were the Church of Satan and LaVey, offering absolutely sexual experimentation, existential experimentation, meaning really get to the core of who you are, yet in a dark light in this case, and also being in favor of law and order and a kind of, I wouldn't say draconian, but, you know, pretty stern view of life, yet filled with freedom to experiment with all these things that sort of enhance life. So in that sense, I think it was very much a product of the 60s that were so diametrically, you know, it was extreme times. The pendulum was going really back and forth. Over the years, his source his source magic was basically his own mind and his own life and his own fetishes from growing up, movies he liked, books that he loved, science fiction, pulp fiction, all these things merged into a magical system. And that was new when you look at the history of magic, because previously it's been about elemental magic and planetary magic and this sort of macro perspective. When you're out there in the cosmos, in a way, trying to draw down forces, and then you have gods from different systems, and it's all very romanticized and a bit abstract. But LaVey was very much of a psychologically oriented figure, and he pulled things from out of himself, like the rabbit in the hat, so to speak, were things that had made him tick as a kid, and that he used that energy to look at it. Why do I still like this, you know, weird radio show from the 1930s? It filled him with something. And then he wove elements like that, and also music, forgotten songs. He was a great musician, and he wove that into his magical system. So for me, as a magical anthropologist, it was very interesting to know him, because he really brought something new to the table. It certainly not for everyone. And by using a symbol like that, of course, you will turn people off. But he wanted to turn a few people on, people who felt that affinity with the outsider, with a kind of contrarian force in a way, and he was quite successful at it. So I would say showman, yeah, to a certain extent, but he was for real in the sense that he had something substantial to offer philosophically and in terms of magic also.
Ultimately, what do you want people to come away with from the new book, Source Magic?
I think it's fairly simple. It's in an anthology of essays that deal with culture, that deal with source magic and magical anthropology. I would love for people to go to realize how inspiring and fun it can be to look at these weird things that are going on in our culture, not specifically from my point of view, but in a point of view that sort of, again, lifts the stones and looks what's underneath here, you know, not just accepting everything that we are force-fed with, but just trying to connect the dots in your own way. So it's a kind of an imperative. I would like for people to think for themselves and to think for themselves in new creative ways and look at whatever they're interested in.
And the book is available at Amazon, I'm guessing?
That's right. And I guess on all major online and physical bookstores. It has good distribution, so it should be easy to find.
And for more information, the website, carlabrahamson.com. And the URL for that is in the episode notes for this podcast. Carl, A great pleasure meeting you. I enjoyed this very much. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here. Thanks.
A new Richard Serrett's Strange Planet drops every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday.
Our kids have said to us since we've moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, of values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See what makes Minnesota the star of the North. New residents share why they love calling it home at exploreminnesota.com/live.
Our kids have said to us since we've moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, of values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See what makes Minnesota the star of the North. New residents share why they love calling it home at exploreminnesota.com/live.